This hour of the Jason Rand Show is brought to you by Farrah.com. There is a lot of news happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending.
What's trending? Let's get political.
So State Senator Mona Das, she's a liar. She is an absolute liar. Several weeks ago, back in June, the Democrat told the Kent Chamber of Commerce that she had personally experienced a whole bunch of hate and misogyny and bigotry, even in Democratic caucus meetings. And so the Democrats did an investigation because they don't want to be seen as promoting this kind of stuff. And they found no evidence whatsoever that it actually happened. Now, before you're saying to yourself, okay, oh, the Democrats did an investigation and found out that they're not racist or bigoted, I've spoken to two people with intimate knowledge of everything Mona Das is talking about. Okay? They told me weeks ago, this just didn't happen. And these are people I completely trust. And they have no reason to lie. None of this happened. Of course, they didn't stop her from making up the claim.
It was hard to go to work every day. The racism and the sexism and the misogyny that we experience is real. And it's not okay anymore. And now when you elect people of color at the table, don't tell us to be quiet.
Oh.
It's not okay.
I mean, did they tell her to be quiet because she was making a bad point? Or they tell her to be quiet because you're a woman of color? We don't allow that in the Democratic Party. Then she calls out specifically Democrats. Not by name, but Democrats in Olympia.
And I will tell you what happens when the caucus door closes. And if that doesn't mean anything to you, it means when the Democrats get together and the Republicans get together to talk about bills, they go into what's called caucus and then they close the door. And after they close that door, that's when it gets real.
What do they do? Mona, what do they do? Tell us.
That's when my 28 colleagues got real. And that's when I heard hate.
Oh.
That's when I heard misogyny.
Oh.
And racism.
Oh, my God.
And sexism.
Oh, my God.
From people you would not expect.
Like who? It's so weird that you're not naming anybody, but you're telling us specifically it's coming from people we don't even expect it to come from.
And that's the type of light that I want to shine, is that when now there are 8 people of color in the Senate Democratic caucus, it was coded language instead.
Oh, it's coded.
Those people.
It's coded.
They would say things that were coded. So
coded.
What I want to share with you is that elections matter.
Totally. It was coded language, meaning it's language that is not actually racist or sexist or homophobic or whatever, but she takes it that way. For example, when someone said, "Good morning, everybody, ladies and gentlemen," why did you assume there were just ladies and gentlemen in this room? That's coded language! That's a microaggression. Tara Parker, the Senate's human resources officer, she interviewed more than a dozen lawmakers for this investigation into whether the policies or workplace conduct were in violation. She wrote that Das told her that she regretted the language she used at the June event and, quote, did not mean to suggest that her fellow caucus members use overtly racist and sexist terms or expressions. So in other words, it didn't actually happen. What happened around the time of these allegations maybe hint at what this is really about. Because if you go back and you look at Mona Das's personal Facebook page, she made an announcement towards the end of June that I thought was rather interesting. She launched a consultancy agency called Moxie. And on Facebook, she said, quote, "We're recruiting, training, mentoring, coaching, and fundraising for women, people of color, LGBTQIA+, and young folks who want to run for office." Doesn't this kind of seem like she needed a story to use to inspire what she's doing with this consultant agency? Doesn't it seem like she's just looking for some additional street cred? Not just to say, "I am an elected woman of color serving with the Democrats in Olympia," but oh my gosh, what I have experienced is something that I know you might experience, and together we can all fight back. Join my cause. There was always something suspicious about this. There was always something suspicious about this. And now we can say an investigation found that there's no evidence to suggest that it did in fact happen. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending on the campaign trail?
So Mark Sanford, the former congressman, former governor of South Carolina, he announced over the weekend that he is running for president. He, the one who cheated on his wife, pretended to be on a hike on the Appalachian Trail to hide the fact that he was actually away with his mistress in where? Buenos Aires, I believe? He was on Fox News Sunday.
I plan to announce that back home this week. We had a hurricane come visit us on the coast of South Carolina, so that sort of disrupted plans on that front. But I'm here to tell you now that I am going to get in.
Just real quick. I get his point. Like, I wanted to do it in my hometown, but I couldn't because we were getting hit by a hurricane. Couldn't you have just postponed a few days? Could you have just been like, okay, you know what? I'm going to be completely ignored in all of this because this is a very significant weather event that people are going to be talking about. You could do tomorrow. Could have got a whole full week's worth of press and then done Fox News Sunday next week.
But it just seems so right on Fox News.
It's just so weird. You can still do it on Fox News in a week. It was just bizarre the way he did it. But his pitch, essentially, is the Republican Party has lost its way, and I'm the one to get us back on track.
I think we need to have a conversation on what it means to be a Republican. I think that as a Republican Party, we have lost our way. And I'd say so on a couple of different fronts. I'd say, first, and sort of the epicenter of where I'm coming from, is that we have lost our way on debt and deficit and spending. You know, one of the hallmarks of the Republican Party and the conservative movement has always been, how much do we spend? I mean, it was Milton Friedman's notion of the ultimate measure of government is how much it spends. I think as a party, we've lost our way. The president has called himself the king of debt, has a familiarity and comfort level with debt that I think is ultimately leading us in the wrong direction. We can get into those numbers, but the numbers are astounding. I just take, for instance, as a data point, this last debt deal that adds $2 trillion of additional debt to our country over the next 10 years adds a third of $1 trillion and new spending, and really there wasn't conversation on that. So I'd say the epicenter where I'm coming from is we've got to have a national conversation and a Republican conversation on where are we going on debt.
So, you know, I actually agree with his point that we need to start having that conversation about where we go with debt as a Republican Party. We started down this path most recently under George W. Bush, who I don't think did a good job from a conservative perspective on dealing with the national crisis. We're certainly not addressing it right now with Donald Trump. And I think that Republicans need to have that conversation. And kudos to Mark Sanford, who wants to start that conversation. He's got no shot in the world of actually winning, right? I mean, we all know that he's not going to go anywhere. But if he wants to be that catalyst for that conversation, okay. Meanwhile, right now, what's happening in North Carolina, oddly enough, is the president, who is currently holding a rally. He's holding it in Fayetteville, North Carolina right now. And let's check in and listen to a little bit of it, because we know that CNN isn't going to cover this.
The prayers of our entire nation are with the citizens of North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, and everyone else that was in the storm's path. And I will say I was called by the government of the Bahamas, and we're helping with the Bahamas. They were hit so hard. They were hit so hard. Who would believe it? We pledge the full support of the federal government through every step of the rebuilding process. And I will say, North Carolina in our country probably got hit the hardest. That was a little bit of a surprise. But I know one thing about North Carolina. You can take it and you'll build it quickly and you'll build it beautifully. And you'll be back sooner than anybody ever thought. And it'll be better than ever, right? No doubt about it. I also want to give a special recognition to the many non-governmental organizations doing so much to help people.
This is President Trump speaking
Dorian
live in Fayetteville, North Carolina. He is thanking folks and their response to Hurricane Dorian.
And he's got an organization, Samaritan's Purse, based right here in North Carolina, and the work that Franklin and his family and all of those that are with Franklin Graham, we want to thank them. They're special, great people. Great people. Thank you, Franklin. Thank you. Incredible job. He does such a great job all over. Wherever there's a problem, you see Samaritan's Purse and Franklin and his people. We love the people of this state, and we will never, ever leave your side. North Carolina will truly recover so fast. I know you people so well. Let's not even talk about it. Let's not even talk about it. We're here tonight to discuss the extraordinary progress we're making as a nation and how to ensure this amazing resurgence keeps on going and going strong. In just over 2 years, we've taken this big, beautiful ship, and it's being turned around very quickly. Nobody thought this would happen. You know, we won the greatest election, certainly one of them, but maybe the greatest, but we won one of the greatest. Let's say one. This way I won't be criticized. They'll say, you know, George Washington had a great election, too. The fake news, right? The fake news.
That's President Trump speaking live in Fayetteville, North Carolina. We'll be keeping an ear on it. I wanted to dip out at that point because this whole idea of fake news, understand that right now CNN is not covering this. MSNBC isn't covering this speech. We're covering this speech. Anybody else speaking in primetime on the East Coast would get their speech covered in full. But because it's the president, they don't want to hear him speak at all. So we'll be keeping an ear on this to make sure that all of the interesting talking points that come out of this actually find their way to you. Send me a text on the None Better Tax Resolution Hotline, 1-800-465-8770. 1-800-465-8770. Send me a text on the None Better Tax Resolution Hotline. We'll be keeping an eye and ear on this Trump rally in North Carolina. But first, let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? The sports ball.
So I guess yesterday the offensive line decided not to show up, and yet still the Seahawks were able to beat the Bengals, but just barely, 21-20 over the Cincinnati Bengals on their home opener. Joining us in studio to talk it all through, almost like a therapy session, is Bob Stelton from 710 ESPN Seattle. So clearly not the game you expected.
No.
Not even close.
No. Outside of the outcome, I expected them to win. I thought they'd win by double digits. We had a reporter on from Cincinnati last week who covers the team who said he was surprised that the spread wasn't at least two touchdowns.
Yeah.
So the guy that sees that team day in, day out thought the Seahawks would beat them by at least two touchdowns. So, listen, I think we talked about this or we had so many conversations, but week one is the toughest in the NFL to predict. Mm-hmm. And it's the toughest for the players to prepare. And I'm not trying to make excuses. Seahawks were really sloppy, had some big, big mistakes happened in this game, but you talk to every one of these teams and they'll tell you it's the toughest week to scheme for, especially for a team like Cincinnati, because A, they've got a new coaching staff, so you don't know what you're seeing. There's no resume there. There's no game tape to go look at other than last year, you know, last year's stuff. You can look at specific players, but it's a new coaching staff, new scheme. You don't have anything to go back on versus now you go into week two, week three, week four. You can go back and look at previous games for your opponent. You don't have that option here. So you get a lot of teams that go in a little bit blind as to what they may see, and oftentimes they don't react well, like the Seahawks didn't react well to a lot.
So I feel like, unless I'm totally crazy, we've been having the conversations of the offensive line for a while now, right?
Last year they were great.
Last year was fine, but before that there were some issues.
They were horrific.
Yeah.
Before last year,
and so
yeah.
We're now back to where it almost, not quite, but it almost starts to seem like we might be reverting.
This game looked like it, I'll
right?
say that.
Yeah.
And what, which was weird because, again, not understanding what the Bengals were going to throw at them defensively. You allow for mistakes. They were really good in the preseason. They looked the starters. Now, they didn't play a ton, but the starters looked really good in the preseason. So this, to me, that was the biggest surprise. The fact that the defense struggled in the secondary, that wasn't a big surprise to me. But the fact that the offensive line played as poorly as they did, really, really struggled with pass blocking. They struggled with run blocking. This was the number one rushing team in the NFL last year, in large part because of that line. I mean, Chris Carson's a great back, but if he doesn't have holes open for him, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So, and you've got the same group except for one player. You've got you got four of the five you had last year. So, you know, to see what they did yesterday was a bit surprising. I'm not going to panic. I'm not going to say, oh, great, they're back to stinking out loud and they're going to be terrible. I think it's week one. They're going to go into Pittsburgh, which is going to be a really tough game. But at least they'll have some game tape. They can look at what Pittsburgh did last night and say, all right, here's how we're going to counter what they do. You didn't have that with Cincinnati.
Now, let's talk about Jadeveon Clowney, who got his first start as a Seahawk. Of course, he became a Seahawk player over through, and kudos to him. He had a lot of leverage over Houston, who said, look, I'll go to two teams, that's it. So it's either slash pain in the ass slash smart, because he's got a lot of leverage. He seemed pretty good for despite not having much time with the Hawks.
He was really good,
right?
Really good, considering what, yeah, the amount of time he played. More snaps than they wanted him to. They wanted to kind of work him into this. He had a presence right away.
Yeah,
even when he didn't it's tough for some of those guys because they can impact a play, but it won't show up on the stat sheet. You look up, they didn't record a tackle, they didn't record a sack, yet they were disruptive, and they forced the quarterback to move out of the pocket, move his feet, and disrupt the play. And he did that, and they started double-teaming him yesterday. Yeah. And this is a guy who's been here, less than a week? So he's had very little time. He was talking about it after the game in the locker room, just trying to keep up with terminology and just working on communicating. I mean, none of that is natural right now, where it's second nature for everybody else. They just understand, whether it's a hand signal, whether it's verbal, whether it's just a look. They understand what's going on, where he's out there sort of flying blind.
Yeah.
Considering the circumstances, a tremendous game and recorded a sack and was disruptive out there.
And to that point, I mean, just imagine a world in which he is up to speed on all of those nonverbal cues and has some time to get the culture of the locker room under his belt. And then he's going to be a huge part of this team.
Yeah, and that seemed to be the consensus amongst guys I spoke to in the locker room last night is, listen, this is the first game of the week, and they killed us underneath. They piled up a lot of yards, but typical of the Seahawks, they bent, but they didn't break. I mean, you look at all the yards. I mean, the Cincinnati Bengals, they dominated them in every category: yardage, time of possession, first downs, you name it. They dominated, except for the score, which is all that matters. Now, they understand, hey, we won the game, and that's the bottom line, but we've got to be better. We are better. Imagine what we're going to be when Chidevian's been here for a period of time. Ziggy Ansah gets out there, their other big acquisition, and Jaron Reed comes back from his 6-game suspension. Those are big pieces to that defense that are going to make a difference.
And it really does seem all about those small mistakes as well. If their kicker didn't miss that field goal, all of a sudden the game is dramatically different.
Yeah. I mean, it's just there's a lot. They forced the Bengals into turnovers. They recorded 5 sacks. That was the biggest concern going into the season, is where are those numbers going to come from? Frank Clark had over 14 sacks last year. Jaron Reed had 10.5. He's missing the first 6 games of the season. Oh, my goodness. What are you going to do? They put up 5 sacks last night, forced 3 turnovers. So as much as we can look at all the yardage they gave up underneath, which was frustrating, and they extended drives, and the defense was on the field too long, I acknowledge all of that. They forced turnovers. They recorded sacks, and they bent, but they didn't break, especially when it came to the red zone.
Last question. Did Russell Wilson live up to the hype of what comes with being the highest paid quarterback in the league?
He only threw the ball 20 times. He only threw it 20 times, and he had 2 touchdown passes, 14 completions. It wasn't an electric day by any stretch, but he was really efficient. My only complaint with Russell on the heels of yesterday's game is that he didn't, when they've got the run-pass option, which is up to him to hand that ball off, he can pass it, or he can run, take the ball himself. He looked to have daylight on probably 3 or 4 plays where he could have taken that corner, had daylight right there, and chose not to. Yeah. Chose to hand the ball off to the running back who ran right into the pile and maybe picked up a yard or two. That was my only complaint with him coming out of that game is, man, it felt like you had some big opportunities you elected not to take advantage of.
Well, they head on over to Pittsburgh next week, and we'll see how that all goes. We'll have Bob coming down into the studio to give us a little bit different take on what's to be expected with that game, as you did going into this Bengals game. Bob Stelton from 710 ESPN Seattle, our sister stations. Thanks for stopping by. Appreciate it.
You got it, man.
So Jason Rancho.
Yelp, Tacoma, Bremerton, Bothell.
This is the Big Local on the Jason Rance Show.
Redmond, Sumner, Kent.
Stories about you, not about Seattle.
Hey, look at the time. 4:30 on a weekday afternoon. That means it's time for the Big Local, brought to you by Sean Keller, Smiles by Design. You see, the media is hyper-focused on the city of Seattle, and they end up ignoring all the important stories that are happening all across Washington State. And so we do the opposite. We ignore Seattle. We focus on the cities that you live in. And we start in Shoreline, where a few teachers apparently quit a high school there because of the religious policies of the school that they consider to be anti-gay. Now, the Seattle Times says at least 5 teachers felt either pushed out or they voluntarily decided to quit over at King's High School after administrative mandate went out that they felt required them to essentially disavow gay marriage, both on the job, but also in their personal lives. Now, keep in mind, this is a private Christian school, so they have every right in the world to do what it is they're accused of doing. There's this new president there of Krista Ministries. Krista Ministries runs a whole bunch of different religious organizations, among them radio stations, and in this case, a school. And her name is Jacinta Tegman. And she gave some kind of address when she first got the job at the school, and she said, according to the Times, that, quote, sexual intimacy is confined within the marriage of one man and woman. So then later, an email apparently went out from the head of this particular school. His name is Eric Rasmussen. And in this email, he basically reaffirmed the school's core religious tenets, the core values. And it apparently repeated the line of sexual intimacy being confined between one man and one woman in this email. And so a lot of people who work for the school, they were like, well, that's kind of weird. Where did that come from? And so they were asking questions like, hey, can I still work here if I don't fully believe in that position? It's not that I'm going to do anything on campus, but in my private life, if I don't actually support this, can I still work here? And so Rasmussen apparently emailed a response back by saying, and this is a direct quote from the email, you can continue to work at King's if you are a Christian, confirm understanding and alignment with our doctrinal statement, and willingly conduct your personal life and professional role of educating our students in a manner that is not in disunity with King's theological beliefs. So my takeaway from that is, yeah, you have to actually believe in this. You have to believe in this whether or not your belief is manifesting itself or lack of belief is manifesting itself on or off campus. And so some people are like, okay, I guess you leave me no choice. I quit. Now, the school isn't saying like this mountain of people decide, this wave of people decided to quit. They're kind of downplaying it a little bit. But clearly some teachers left. In fact, some students left. They have this one quote from a student there who came out when he was 17 years old. And he said, you know what? This is not the right school for me. I think this position of calling out same-sex marriage is going to lead to kids who are LGBTQ going through an additional amount of bullying or anxiety that they don't need to go through. So I'm going to go ahead and leave myself. Now, the truth of the matter is I'm glad these teachers left and I'm glad that that particular student left. If you do not believe in the principles of this school, you shouldn't teach there. You shouldn't go there. I disagree with their perspective on this. I would, if I was in this position, allow people who happen to support gay rights or gay marriage be a part of the team. But I'm not in charge, and neither are these teachers. This is a school that every single person who decided to teach at, every single person signed up to work there. Literally signed a statement that very clearly detailed all of these beliefs. This is not something new. This was just something that was stated once more, reaffirmed. They believe that the scriptures are inerrant and of final authority. If that does not work for your perspectives, your personal religious beliefs, you get to have them. They just don't want you being a teacher there. And I understand that perspective. I disagree with it, but I understand the perspective. And it's one of those stories that is meant to get everybody all riled up. Oh my gosh, these bigots at this school. No, I don't think they have any nefarious intent in what it is they believe in any decision that they make. I believe that they are deeply religious and this is a religious perspective that they subscribe to and they're not forcing it on you. In fact, they're doing this in a way for your own comfort. And so if you don't want to live, you don't work there, you don't want to go there, that's on you, a position I respect. A position that I understand, but this is not some big story that we should all be outraged by. Meanwhile, in Tacoma, speaking of schools, the state of Washington, this is the second year in a row where we have decided, due to a law, to outlaw lunch shaming, which was certainly well-intentioned when it was pitched. But I remember saying at the time, you're going to get a whole lot of unintended consequences from this. You're trying to be all woke, trying to be all social justice-y, and it's not really going to work out. And right now, we're starting to see yet again how flawed this policy actually is. Tacoma Public Schools started the school session $130,000 in debt because of this law. Federal Way, $30,000 in debt. Bellevue and Bethel, about $21,000, $22,000 in debt. Everett, a little under $6,000. Because under this law against lunch shaming, students all across Washington State at a public school, you can't deny them any meals. You can't give them a specific lesser kind of meal if they're unable to pay. You have to give them exactly what you would give everybody else because some kids were being shamed, apparently, picked on for being quote-unquote poor because they didn't bring any money and they couldn't afford to get the school lunch. And it's very obvious to tell who those kids are because they're not eating any food when you are. But of course, this doesn't actually mean that the lunch is free. You still have to pay for the lunch. So now schools are on the hook for all the missing funds, and they're all like, what are we supposed to do here? We're now in Tacoma. We've got $130,000. We're in debt. Where's this money supposed to come from? Jeffrey Liu is a school lunch dad who raised a whole bunch of money for the lunch debt. And a lot of people say, hey, why don't we raise more money like that dude did that one time? But he's saying that's not actually a good solution. I'm happy to donate money, but that's not a long-term solution.
Banning lunch shaming is good progress, but it's not an ideal solution. I won't stop until we find that permanent solution. Fundraising is not a solution. I know it's like a Band-Aid. Band-Aids come off, and once this money is paid, lunch debt will continue.
So part of the issue here is that you've got a whole bunch of subsidies that are, in fact, available to these kids, to these parents of these kids, but a lot of them aren't actually signing up. So in at least the Tacoma School District, my assumption is these other school districts doing the exact same thing. They're saying, hey, guess what? Here's what's available to you. Here's the information that you need. All you have to do is make this phone call or visit this website or go to this office and sign up, and we'll go ahead and take care of it for you so you don't have to worry. The money is there. We just need you to go that one small step. And instead of sending your kid without any money to the school, just please, please, please sign up for this stuff so we can get the money. So I'm hoping that this corrects itself. But again, these unintended consequences were so obvious. We saw them a mile away. And it's to the point where schools were attempting, because this is not specific to Washington itself, this issue. It's happening all across the country. You had some schools that were coming up and saying, okay, we want to feed you, but the lunch actually costs something. So instead of this hot lunch, we'll give you a cold lunch. We'll give you a ham and cheese sandwich. We'll give you peanut butter and jelly. We'll give you something else. But then all of a sudden, all the woke parent activists on Twitter, whose kids don't even go to the schools they're complaining about, stepped up and were like, well, actually, that's just as bad as lunch shaming, because everyone knows that the poor kids get the ham and cheese sandwich or the tuna sandwich, even though it's cheaper. They know. It's just like, okay, there's no winning here. And so now you've got a lot of schools that are in desperate need of some funding. Finally, City of Kirkland is trying to help city workers find housing that's nearby, because according to the Seattle Times, about 85% of them don't actually live in the City of Kirkland, despite working for the City of Kirkland. And they note that it's expensive to buy a home in that particular city. There's not a ton of rental properties available. The ones that are available are either already taken or pretty expensive. So if you're someone who doesn't make a lot of money, let's say you're low or middle income, you're not really able to live there. Now, I'm personally not sure that that matters. In a lot of these cases for city workers, I don't think, let's say you're a janitor in the building, you need to have an attachment to the city. You can live somewhere else. I don't think that matters. But certainly, it's not a bad thing living in the city that you work for, because at least you have a little bit more of buy-in in that case. And so instead of actually just giving people a whole bunch of discounts, they're saying, hey, let's work with the private market, the marketplace, and figure this out. So they decided over in the city to work with a development company that has 34 units in two buildings in downtown Kirkland, and they're holding them specifically for city workers to apply. Now, again, they're not giving them a discount, but they are saying that these options happen to be cheaper than the other spots, and so this is part of a strategy to check that out. They're going to do it for about 12 months, figure it all out. That seems like a good that's a good way to address this problem, if it's in fact a problem. I'm not entirely sure I get why someone would work for a city that they don't live in if they don't already have the buy-in or are just looking for a paycheck to do something that they're passionate about, right? It seems weird to say, well, you're not going to really, we should just have you live here if you're the janitor or if you're the lifeguard at a city park. I just don't think that that is necessary. So short of raising the paychecks of people whose work would not be commensurate with the amount of money that would be required for them to be able to afford a home, whether we're talking about rent or purchase, this seems like the best move. So kudos to them for doing something like this. We'll see what it does. We'll see. Maybe it doesn't work at all. Maybe the 85% of people who work for Kirkland are like, look, I work here. I don't want to spend any more time here. I work here and know how the sausage is made. And so I think I'd be better off in Bellevue or Redmond or Bothell. We'll find out. But I like this idea. How about you? 1-800-465-877 if you want to send me a text on the None Better Tax Resolution Hotline. 1-800-465-877. Welcome back to the Jay Zoran Show, live in the Online Trading Academy studio. Thank you so much for tuning in. Really do appreciate it. I don't know if you noticed this, but Democrats today were out in full force. It was all a strategic move to push for universal background checks legislation, even though not only is it flawed, but it doesn't just do universal background checks. Now, Patty Murray was out there with a tweet saying, during our first day back in session, Senate Majority Leader McConnell should call for a vote on a House-passed bipartisan universal background check legislation. RT, if you agree. Just real quick, stop that! RT, if you agree. That is how you use Twitter 5.5, 6 years ago. We don't do that anymore. You know what happens when you agree? You retweet it on your own. We don't need to be pushed into it. Patty, it's not even like, the thing is, that's a tweet that sounds like Patty Murray actually wrote, but she didn't write it. Someone on her staff did. Chuck Schumer, the House, or the, I was going to say House Minority, the Senate Minority Leader, said, President Donald Trump, Speaker Pelosi, and I are writing to you because it's long past for McConnell to put the House-passed bipartisan background checks bill up for a vote. This time, you need to act before more lives are lost. Now, they're specifically pushing H.R. 8, House Resolution 8. Now, we've talked about this in the past, but let's be clear about something, because they're lying. They're lying about what's in it. They're 100% lying about what's in it, but they're hoping to take advantage of the recent mass shootings to put political pressure on folks to put this up for a vote. It's not going to go up for a vote. Smartly, I think Mitch McConnell doesn't want to put senators on the record to say no to this because they know it's going to be used against them come their reelection campaigns. And so Mitch McConnell is taking all the heat for this. He can just simply say he's giving a pass basically for all the other senators not to have to go on the record on this, because if they go on the record and vote no, what's going to end up happening is CNN, MSNBC, New York Times, all these other outlets are going to pretend, oh, they had the opportunity to vote for universal background checks, but they said no. Here's why it's a bad bill. H.R. 8 requires that loans, gifts, sales of any firearm be processed by a gun store. This covers about 99.9% of the transfers of weapon. You'd go through a bunch of paperwork and pay fees each and every time that you're doing this. Now, maybe you think that's fine. Maybe you think that makes sense, because you know what? If producer Peyton wants to go out and purchase a weapon from me, an extra spare, we should make sure that he's all on the up and up. And I generally agree with that. Here's what I don't agree with. Let's say we're both going down to Wade's in Bellevue and we're just shooting. We're at the range. If I were to give him my gun or him give me his gun, don't think he owns one, but in this magical world, let's say you do, for him just to give it to me, to fire just a few shots, just to feel it, just to see how it handles. Maybe I'm thinking about buying that particular Glock. Maybe I'm this close to purchasing. If we did that, we would be treated, or likely Peyton would be treated, the same way as if he literally sold it knowingly to a felon. That doesn't make any sense to me. I shouldn't have to go through all the paperwork. I shouldn't have to pay a fee if I'm at a gun range and my buddy lets me handle his weapon for a couple of shots. That's ridiculous. And we sure as hell should be treated the same way as if I were an actual felon. That's ridiculous. Beyond that, let's go through what this actually does. Because let's say you're someone who is being stalked. Maybe you're someone who is the potential victim of domestic violence. You believe that you're going to be victimized. Unless you are in imminent danger in the moment, you're not able to handle a weapon. Unless you purchase the weapon legally. So let's say someone hands you their weapon for the weekend when they're going to be out of town. You've had some run-ins. Say it's your spouse. If you use that weapon, if you hang on to that weapon for self-defense, if you believe you're going to become the victim of stalking, someone who's going to actually show up to your house, you do not get an exemption. Let's go even further. In this bill that I'm told is simply about universal background checks, Patty Murray says so. Oh, but it also bans handguns for persons 18 through 20. So let's just say you're a 20-year-old woman living in Tukwila or Burien. Maybe you're in unincorporated Snohomish County. If you wanted to purchase a handgun for self-defense, you don't get to have one if you're a 20-year-old. You can't even borrow it from someone if you believe you're in need. H.R. 8 is a bad idea. Oh, hey, look at this. The attorney general in any state is allowed to require that every single gun store charge a fee per weapon. A fee on which there is no cap on it. So maybe it's a dollar. That seems reasonable. Maybe it's $1 million. Because we certainly have attorney generals out there, or attorneys general out there, like Bob Ferguson, who really, really, really loathe guns. And I see them making it incredibly onerous to purchase a gun. They don't care because they don't want you having that gun. H.R. 8 is not a universal background check bill. It is not. And anytime someone wants to push that towards you, it is your duty as someone who supports the Second Amendment or just someone who supports constitutional rights, period, it is your duty to call them out. They think you're stupid because the truth of the matter is not a single person who's even listening to me right now is going to read H.R. 8. The people out there who are saying on Twitter, retweeting Patty Murray at her request, you think they read H.R. 8? You think they have any idea what's in House Resolution 8? Do you even think they know it exists? They just know that they like the idea of background checks. And they're going to shame anyone who doesn't get on board. That's dangerous. It's incredibly, incredibly dangerous. It's the whole idea of just putting something on, just making a claim that's baseless. Why don't they just call it background checks and we love puppies, Bill? Make it even harder for those of us who care about our Second Amendment rights to push back. This is done intentionally. And they know that. And that's what bothers me the most in all of this. Because if Democrats truly wanted just to do a reasonable background check, Bill, that would get passed. A reasonable gun background check would get passed. It would get passed right now in the Senate. Republicans would jump on board. And they should. I think most people out there, including gun owners, support the general idea of a universal background check. I think if you're going to buy a gun, you should go through a check. Fine. We can have a reasonable discussion on how long you have to wait, how long you have until the police department, and which department's going to look into the back. We can have all those details. We can have that debate. But overall, that idea is incredibly popular. They could pass that right now if they wanted to, but they don't. They're not happy with just doing that. Because they know by keeping this bill from passing, they could demonize the Republicans. They can demonize Mitch McConnell. They can use this for political purposes while people die. The people that they claim that they really care about. Because remember, they're doing this because people are out on the street dying from gun violence needlessly. Now, they're not actually going to do anything to address it, but they will give the appearance of doing something to address it. I'd love to hear from you on this. 1-800-465-8770. 1-800-465-8770. Send me a text message on the None Better Tax Resolution Hotline.